I want to talk about China for a while. You mentioned Tencent, your play, Prosus, NicePass. And I'm looking at other South African companies that have exposure in China. Does Discovery feature? You've got the whole Ping An play from a health perspective. Is that another entry point? And are there any other entry points that you can talk to us about?
So unfortunately for Discovery, Discovery has been a short of ours for about a decade. I think that we entered the short somewhere around 140 or 150 rand. It's now 135 rand, almost a decade late. The stock for us has always looked really, really expensive. Not so much on a normalized earnings basis, because the normalized earnings look to grow, but they seem to strip out the effect of interest rates, for example, in those earnings. That's the latest round of earnings adjustments. We never saw that a few years ago, but in the last few years, as we went into the zero rate environment and we came out of the zero rate environment, there's been a new adjustment for interest rates. So we always like to look at cash earnings, and particularly with Discovery, the cash earnings just haven't been there yet. I think we're getting moderately more warm to it because, you know, a life business is continuing to grow.
But that interest in Ping An hasn't picked up.
The interest in Ping An hasn't picked up. You know, there was a potential, we think, call for capital at Ping An, which Discovery, I'm not sure we're that interested in following on. But if you look also at the share price of Ping An, it's probably halved over, you know, the last couple of years. So nothing too exciting.
Definitely don't want to dwell on a stock that are not interested in. Let's talk then to any other entry points into China. Is it only Prosus NicePass so that you can play?
No. So I think there are interesting other opportunities. I mean, NetEase, JD Group. So there are good businesses. We owned a stake in Pindao Dao. Don't know how many of you follow that. PDD is the share code. It's got an very interesting, like, centralized buying group. It's almost like a step above, like, an Amazon, etc. But it's had a massive run. Sold down, probably doubled over the last few months. But I think particularly, which I can't understand, and I do understand from a flows perspective why Chinese tech hasn't done well. There's been a lot of indices even created in emerging markets now that are emerging market index excluding China. Because managers, global managers, particularly US managers, got so upset with the poor performance of the Chinese market that they've now created all these indices without China. And I think that's still created more flow out of China. And hopefully that's, you know, somewhere near an end.
I just want to make sure that I've heard you correctly on China, because the number one detractor from a number of asset managers is the regulatory environment. But you're saying they're starting to take cognizance of how the market is impacted by regulatory changes, i.e. unwinding of one of the most recent decisions.
Yeah.
So for you, it's not a risk at all.
It's always a risk. I mean, the Chinese are unknown. So, you know, something could change. We just get the sense that the underlying companies are doing well. Earnings are going to be good. The buybacks are in place. The buybacks are much bigger than they were before. And the regulation at least has been removed. So we'd be very surprised by suddenly a new surprise regulation. I mean, the fact that they were withdrawn so quickly, the minister was actually removed. Who knows what happened to him? Hopefully he wasn't removed permanently. But that's and then literally on the rhetoric on the web, even the website page was all taken off within a 24-hour period. So we're feeling more comfortable about it. I don't think we're the only manager. There's another manager sitting in the audience here who's talking tomorrow. I think he's probably got the same theory or the same idea as David from Peregrine. But I think we're starting to get, and we are. We've taken a decision. And that's what we paid for. We paid to take.
You said your investment analyst went and spent some time in China. Must say, having spent some time in Beijing and Dalian, I would possibly say that may have been.
Yeah.
That's just for us on the stage. Let's talk about South Africa. And I got a really optimistic sense that I could go out there and buy a basket of stocks and I'm going to do well. You mentioned that, correct me if I'm wrong, 56 out of 58 months.
50 out of 68. Doesn't
50 out of 68, you've beaten the passive index. Or the index, that's on the local front. am I right in saying I can go out there, it's like Christmas at the moment, and buy? Have I got to be very picky?
I think you've got to buy quality. There are businesses performing better than others. You know who they are. I mean, I wouldn't advise you to go out, start buying pick and pay, even though Sean...
Even the unbundling...
Yeah, I don't know if Sean's in the room or not. He's not. I don't think so. Even though Sean's stepping into and he's an excellent manager, but you're up against the likes of a ShopRite who is spending as much in CapEx annually that you're going to raise from the market to fix your balance sheet in a one-off. So your competition is really slamming you at all fronts. I know, for example, landlords are asking pick and pay in major shopping centres, please move out, because we have pressure from our other tenants to say they're not getting football because you're in the mall. They want a Checkers and they want a Woolies. They don't want to pick and pay. So how's that going to change, you know, over the short term? Yeah, so I think it depends what you buy. I think ShopRite's outperformed pick and pay maybe 10x over the past 10 years. I mean, it's a phenomenally well-run business. Yes, it's maybe expensive now. It's on a 20 multiple, but would I buy pick and pay into recovery? No.
At the BizNews 4 conference 2 years ago, you were on stage with Pete. You shared the view that banks were a good buy then across the board. You still share that view?
Yeah, so we've downweighted a little bit of our banks. Like Pitt, we still own them. We were quite disappointed with Absa's results the other day, but really it was about the extra provisioning they'd taken, where, you know, the write-offs were above, let's say, their top of the range. So we're still hopeful going forward. I mean, you're getting paid a 9.5% dividend yield on Absa to wait. So you've got a 9.5% yield, which is better than you can get in, you know, any fixed deposit. And I still think over time you will get growth out of these banks. Small growth, but growth. So I think it's a safe option. FirstRand, for example, we like a little bit more now because it was sold down on fears of the Aldermore book, which is the in the UK, the motor book, having to provide based on new regulation coming into play in the UK. And I think that, you know, that is probably not going to be as big as the market anticipates. So we like that bank. The one, unfortunately, we haven't owned in Capitec has absolutely shot the lights out. It trades at, you know, 5 or 6 times its book, which is an unusual circumstance for any bank in the world. But we have to give them credit that they've done a phenomenal job.
So when you say you forecast, you look the micro environment and decide the future, surely the rhetoric from the banking CEOs right now is bad debts are going up, consumers in trouble, corporates are in trouble, there's going to be a shallow interest rate cutting cycle, so that's not going to alleviate. Doesn't that augur quite badly for banks in the short term?
We are in, like, our hedge funders, for example, and say which banks we are short, one or two banks, and long one or two. So some banks are more expensive than other banks. But I think on the whole, the banking sector is not that expensive. It's not priced for growth. The dividend yields are high. They're trading at close to 1x book, which means they're trading at their NAVs. They're not particularly expensive. And yes, because things are not good at the moment, so the provisions are very high, which have already.
So just one question with two legs. You can ask two questions.
Oh, you can.
But so the first one is on gold. So gold's bought it from its long-term sort of correlation with real rates. And you think that's sustainable? Where's that going? Second question is your contextual cues to see where you are on the cycle. Do you have one or two IP points you may share?
Where we are on which side?
Yeah, so you decide, like you were saying, bits 1 year, maybe they do very well. You guys try and beat every year, and there's maybe decisions on where you are on the cycle.
Right. Okay.
How you know?
How do we know we're there? I think for us, first, I'll answer that one first. For us, it's a matter of valuation and what we see coming. So, you know, if you take us last year, we weren't very good in the macro environment. We saw two major geopolitical events, you know, one starting the year before, Russia, Ukraine, and then the Israel-Gaza conflict, and rates increasing dramatically as well. And, you know, our vision was actually wrong. We thought markets should come off, discount rate is higher, more political tension, and gold we thought should have run last year. Yeah. I think inflation remained much more stubborn than we felt. and that put a bit of a lid on, I think, gold for a while. But as you can see now, the gold price has had a very significant run. And gold shares, particularly if you take back 2 or 3 months, were trading at multiples that you actually haven't seen and were far cheaper than any of their global counterparts. So we were actually long Harmony and Gold Fields and Anglo Gold, which for us, as a even in the hedge fund, is something quite unique. They have, however, had a massive run. We don't know how long, you know, gold will follow through for. So we have reduced our position a lot. But I would hazard a guess that gold may still have upside, particularly if we see rates starting to come lower. Because it doesn't look to us like the geopolitical tension is about to ease. It may, in fact, even escalate on the northern border. In that point of view, we're not negative necessarily gold. On the other part, it really depends on, you know, what our view, where we think we currently are. We're a little bit excited about South Africa versus, for example, the US, just from a valuation perspective. We also are very much coupled with China, and because we're a little bit more bullish China than we have been in the past, you'll find that the South African market generally does well when the Chinese market does well. Commodities do well, our tech does well. So we're not that. I think with shorting as well, it's become a very big science, and Pitt made alluded to a little comment about markets are not real at the moment. I'm not saying they're not so real, but there are a lot of other factors now playing into share price performances outside of fundamentals. A lot of it's to do, obviously, with the amount of money the Fed is pumping in. So your quantitative tightening, which hasn't really taken place, is actually still quantitative easing. So you've got a lot more money flowing into the market than you think. And then there is a lot of shortage of scrip, particularly in a lot of these, well, them garbage companies. So the free float is actually a lot lower than you think. There's also a lot more options being traded than ever before. I mean, if you look at the size of the Tesla option market, there's actually an entire Twitter page devoted to Tesla call options. You know, stocks are being manipulated on the back of shorter dated call options. And scrip is not readily available. So some of these shares are 30 or 40% of the free float shorted. So the price may be 600 times worth what it, you know, trading at 6 times more than it's worth. But the chance of it coming down in the short term is probably very remote because it's all a function of, you know, what scrip is available in the.
It hasn't become emotional for you with Tesla, has it?
It hasn't. It's not. I'm not an
emotional investor. This is Elon Musk.
It's not. I did notice Pitt called himself Stoic. And you know there's registration plate on his car. Stoic Western Province. Saw that today, actually. Thought that was quite classic.
There's your observation. But as long as it's not emotional, this is.
It's not emotional, but it's factual.
It's obviously, that's house of cards.
It's not a total house of cards, but it's really at least fivefold over value. Based on numbers.
But you still need to be patient.
You have to be patient and you have to be wary that there's a lot of manipulations, particularly in the US market, that we don't see in the South African market. Like what you saw with GameStop a number of years ago. You've got to be careful.
Si, at BizNews 4, we had a chat about the way you guys evaluate companies. And obviously after, it was in the middle of the, just after the COVID epidemic, and it was about cash on the balance sheet and what companies were worth, the way you, your whole perception of valuation. You look at a company like Palantir with no debt on the balance sheet, flying, good technology, a nice funnel or order book going forward. What do you?
You know, they mentioned AI in their results probably 25 times in one page. I'm a little bit suspect about that business. I mean, not from a growth point of view. I mean, it seems to be growing very fast and AI has played right into their hands. But just in understanding what they actually do, I mean, they've got all these defense contracts. They're doing AI in strange things. They're helping with, I think, Trump maybe with his election and, you know, data servicing. I'm not sure how call it kosher the underlying fundamentals are. And it's had an enormous run. And that stock was listed at like $4. It went to 32, a crash back to 60, now it's back to $25. If you look at it again on the basis of what it currently earns, it's very expensive. So again, it's one of these AI beneficiaries. I know Alec mentioned it at the outset. You know, it's playing off the NVIDIAs and everybody, but I really do believe that a lot of these stocks this is their kind of year. And I think that in time, the hype will disappear around them. I can't really understand NVIDIA chip manufacturer being worth $2.1 trillion, when an Apple is only worth slightly more and a Microsoft's worth slightly more. And all that is a manufacturer, of chips, really. And yes, the chips are AI and they're more advanced, but what about all the other chip companies and when they'll catch up and their technology changes? And there will be technology changes. I wouldn't be a buyer.
If you were to pick five Chinese stocks today, Alibaba, Tencent, BYD, and
I think NetEase maybe, JD.com, NetEase, Tencent. I'm not sure Alibaba. But Baba's a bit of a strange one. If you look at the number of shares, they're an issue. They seem to increase at a very big rate. So one of the reasons Chinese market hasn't done very well is companies haven't really bought back shares. They've actually issued a lot of shares. So you see this, this growth in market cap over a long period of time, and you think the market would have done well, yet the market's declined because there's been a constant issue of shares. That's why we like those that are doing, big buybacks like Tencent.
Thank you. 2 years ago, we thought Purple Group was fantastic. Now, we're not quite sure. What's your feeling?
Yeah, so I see Charles Savage is here outside, and I'm sure he's listening to me, yeah? And, I made a comment a couple of years ago that I thought it was expensive at R2. I don't really follow it. I looked at the fundamentals at the time. The stock is now a third of that price. I think you got to wait for Charles to see what the prospects are about. Yeah. You got to ask. I haven't followed it, but I do know that it's a very difficult market to break into. The proportional share market and the online, for example, portfolio share market. I look at a business like Interactive Brokers globally, who are listed. IBKR is the code. Look at that business. That business does all of that. Does it across the entire globe, in any currency, in any stock, and you can do it, live, real time. In fact, you don't even have to move your money from, let's say, dollars to euros or to Swiss francs or whatever. It just automatically does a negative across all currencies. You can proportionately own shares. So it does everything that you would ever need to do and does it on scale at a very cheap rate. And, just don't see how anyone can really compete against it.
So, yes. You're very bullish on China. Parts of China. My understanding is that you cannot hold shares directly in a Chinese company. It's through a nominee shareholder, through the Cayman Islands. That sounds very risky to me. What's your view on the risk?
Yeah, so they're variable interest entity structures that you have to have. They've stood the test of time. So some people, even like Pitt, I think, have argued in the past it would never own NASPAS because it owns its share in Tencent via this VIE structure, and that could never sell it. And then when it came to the fact, NASPAS decided to continually sell their Tencent stake and buy back their own NASPAS shares. They've been doing that ongoing now for a couple of years. So the ease of being able to do it seems to be there. I don't think China would ever step away from that and almost say, sorry, we're nationalizing every investment. As I said, in my mind, they've done the reverse. They've realized they need foreign investment in their market. Yes, it has to be traded, if you're a foreigner, by the Hong Kong market, not directly in the Chinese market. But, the two trade kind of on a pari passu basis. So, it's always been a very small risk and a niggle, I suppose, in the back of people's minds, but the structure has held up well. And you've seen particularly, and the good thing I think about being a South African in that, in South Africa, unfortunately, but South Africa and China have a very good relationship, like we do with Russia and seem to have with most of the wrong countries in the world. So I don't believe the Chinese would ever, say to a South African company, your VIE is, is cancelled.
So you don't use Pete's thesis on staying away from acronyms. BRICS,
no.
For you,
this is fine.
Is in play. I want to talk a bit about your hedge fund, BN4. You were saying that the perception in South Africa is that hedge funds are very risky, but it's actually the opposite because of the regulatory environment. And you made the comment that your hedge fund actually carries less risk than many of your other funds. Can you elaborate, and has that changed?
It definitely hasn't changed. I mean, you'll be hearing from another hedge fund manager this year as well. They're speaking tomorrow, I think, primarily on their hedge fund. So generally, how our hedge fund operates is we're trying to produce an absolute return above cash, but using the market to do it. So we'd have a series of quoted long investments, so companies we like, investments we like, and we'll match those to a large extent against short companies, businesses we don't like, let's say that are in the same industry that we think are overpriced relative to the ones that we do like. They act as a natural hedge against each other, therefore the term hedge fund. And on a net basis, for example, in the 2023 year, our net exposure to equities, if you added up our longs less our shorts, ran at about 25%. Now, a balanced fund even runs, at 60, 70%. An equity fund obviously runs at 100%. We were running at 25%. And even while running at 25%, we then have structures to protect that 25% in case there is any major market turmoil. We even protect, call it really out of the money in case Putin did something crazy. The idea is always within our fund is to try and protect the capital at all costs. It does mean where you're in flat markets and stuff, there is a bit of a cost of protection. So you don't make as, much in where there's not many opportunities. So, last year we didn't even make 10% on the fund. But on average, the fund has done, close to 15% per year for, 16 or 17 years. And the idea is really to make a consistent return in bad or good markets. And obviously, where you think things are very cheap, you may not have a 25, we might have like a 45% net. Different funds run different nets, and ours has just really always been a very conservative fund relative to our other funds, etc. An example that worked very well year to date, in January and February, the market was down probably like 6% or so, and we were up probably 4 or 5%. You've seen an 11% swing because we've got low net equity, markets have come off, the shorts have done very well, and the longs have kind of held their own range. So it's got a very useful, consistent return profile compared to an equity fund. But you probably won't ever see the 30s and 40% that you see.
You've also spoken extensively about an underpin to your style, moving quite aggressively between different stocks, different sectors, once the cycle has run. More so than other players, that definitely came to light when you had the discussion with Pete on stage.
Yeah, so we definitely do that a lot more. I mean, if you've taken us in the midst of COVID, we were very long, for example, the PGMs. I mean, all of them, the Impalas, the Sibanyas, the Amplats, even the Northams. At one stage in our equity fund, we were 10% over the benchmark. We had like 18%. In our hedge fund, we had 10%. That cycle, we realized, hit a ridiculous high. We sold out in the hedge funds. We were short. We held nothing in the longs. We've watched them come down, 80% almost. And now we're almost neutralizing our position back again. We've been buying some actually for the first time in our long-only funds. So you would have found us massively long, massively short, now buying again. So you'll find that in most sectors. I mean, last year, we've been a proponent of a short property trade for many, many years. But last year in 2023, we actually long a whole lot of property stocks and did very well. Property happened to land up being the best asset class, the best domestic asset class in South Africa last year in the equity space was the property sector. You never know. But so,
were you playing the REITs?
The REITs.
And across the board?
Across the board. I mean, the growth points at under 10 Rand, we had Fairvest. Fairvest actually in COVID was 95 cents. Luckily bought out the entire PIC stake. And the stock 4 years later is 3 Rand 80. So you can make money in REITs. You've just got to time it better.
We've got Magnus later this afternoon. And obviously we're going to be focusing very much on the global spectrum and perhaps just laying the groundwork for that a little further. You've spoken about the US and you've spoken about China, but you had also mentioned in your prior appearance on stage here at this news conference that you were beefing up your international desk, so to speak, your research team. You spoke extensively of new hires that you had made and that pursuing beating the global indices was something that you were determined to do.
As I said in my initial story, I'm not sure it's possible over the long term. We've done it. We've hired more professional investment people. We had two ladies join us actually out of the UK, come back to South Africa, very high qualified. One of them was, you know, involved in managing global money. We have also a New York-based manager who works with us in Johannesburg. They're all good. But has it resulted? We've been managing global long-only money for about 6 years now. Has we managed to beat the index? No, we haven't. So we're about...
So what decision do you make going forward? Well, is it the patient game? Do you continue putting resources into it?
So we've told clients, honestly, I mean, I'm invested in it. We believe at some stage, obviously, there will be some correction to passive because, as Pitt says, these are quite expensive stocks driving the index, but the continual flow goes into them on a daily basis. So do I believe a South African manager can outperform the passive index over the next decade? I'm actually probably say no. But maybe some people feel more comfortable about having a balanced portfolio of long ideas that doesn't carry that kind of risk. I mean, there's another player in here who's very good at that internationally, Sean Besh, who's got a really decent, product, offshore, long only manager. Even if he hasn't beaten the index in some years or it has overall, it's a solid portfolio of stocks that have real value that you can go to bed at night and the next day, no, you're not going to be down if there's a Nvidia's Intel suddenly make a chip that's better than Nvidia and the stock's down 80%. You can sleep with a better portfolio. So we hopefully offering a more balanced portfolio. And there will be times where, passive will probably underperform, but it doesn't seem that likely over a longer period.
We talked about China, and what about India?
So India is very, very interesting. I'm potentially taking a trip there in the next couple of months, and we have done quite extensive work into India. It really is exciting, and it seems to a lot of managers who used to have money in China or all in India. As a market, it's grown to a bigger market cap than China. The problem is the valuations. The valuations look exceptionally pricey. There's good growth, and I think the runway is long, but you have to get on the ground there and understand them. And I mean, you look at what happened with the biggest listed group in India, turned out to be a fraud, Adani, Bollerton. One of the biggest research firms in the US, Hindenburg Research, who do in-depth analysis to try and find out these, call it frauds, and they write 200 to 800 page reports. They identified Adani as a fraud. But even Adani, which collapsed, has even recovered somewhat, even knowing that half the elements of the company are not real. So I think you've got to be wary. You need to have a lot of local knowledge. And you need to invest in industries that you really understand, and you need to understand the accounting. It's not that easy. It's like China a little bit. It's not a given on the accounting.
Are there any more frauds in South Africa?
No, hopefully not. So we've had our fair share of them, but hopefully they're gone.
Territories, going back to geography, other than your emerging markets, Europe, would you look to Europe for any investment opportunities at the moment?
I think Europe is cheap. I mean, people often think South Africa's done very badly in the market. I mean, the UK actually hasn't done really much better, and most of Europe has done rather poorly. It's really just this pocket of the US that has continually performed at a wonderful rate over the last decade. I mean, beyond anyone's expectations. So there is reasonable value in some of the UK and European names. And we probably would, we do like a couple of those businesses.
If I was to say to you, you had an option to invest either SA Inc. or the US today, one or the other, what would you do?
Over the next couple of months, I would choose SA into the election. I'm positive And I don't think we get a doomsday coalition. Post that, longer term, no doubt. Maybe not the top most expensive names, but really you've got much greater selection, much better liquidity. And as you can see, there's been no incentive for any new companies to come to this market even. We haven't seen a good listing here, I don't even know, for maybe a decade. What we've seen is delistings. No ability to extract the proper value from businesses here. So even if you've got a good business that's better than a US business, it's probably not ever going to attain the same kind of value that it should. So,
well, I would like this next couple of months scenario. Tell me what I should be buying. Just give me five stocks.
So I think the Mr. Prices, Sanlam, Verstrand, Dis-Chem. I mean, Dis-Chem spoke last week at the Merrill Lynch Sun City conference. Very interesting. It's one of the two stocks I think that's got huge growth potential from already being quite a big company. They're really looking to bring in their cost structures more in line with Clicks. And within 3 days of the conference, the stock went from 29 to 32. So it is up like 10 or 15%. But that's the kind of company that will do exceptionally well. And I think just generally the well-run good companies in SA are too cheap, any metric, but they need a better SA sentiment. And if there is a better SA sentiment, they'll all re-rate.
But the opportunity is the upcoming election and the doomsday scenario that most people are plugging into their models, which you don't believe will materialize.
Hope there won't.
So I don't want to sound like a doomsday prophet, but I think the elephant in the room that we ignore on a geopolitical scale is the war in the Middle East. I think it has the potential to get a lot worse, and there will be ramifications then in Europe and in the States. Obviously, we all regret that, but that is a real consequence. How do you factor that in?
Yeah, so that does make us a little bit more bullish gold. Look, I think the approach has been pretty measured. I don't want to give any of my political views really around it, but I do think that the greater Muslim population in the Western world part of the Middle East, the Saudi Arabias, etc., are still staying exceptionally neutral to the conflict, which I think is important. Obviously, there's a big variable in Iran because you don't really understand what could come out of Iran and how many other proxies could be ignited and could be ignited in as you say, the US or other parts of Europe. So it is a big risk. And hopefully this Israel insurgence into Gaza doesn't last too long and they're able to, end it, but hopefully end it, sooner rather than late, and it doesn't escalate. I think that's the bigger issue to me is the Hezbollah on the northern front, and it seems to be slowly gearing up. And if, Iran decides to force them to, have a full-scale attack, we do enter a war at a larger scale than we've seen in Gaza. So I'm hopeful that doesn't happen. If it does happen, it's funny, but wars don't seem to affect the markets too badly. As long as we're not getting a real shock event or being nuclear or, something on a massive scale, it's amazing that the markets have kind of ignored it. More focused on global liquidity, Fed QE versus QT, interest rates, so it's quite astounding. I suppose it's just hope it doesn't escalate too badly.
So in business television, we have a declining viewership, and today is like a dream come true for anybody in the television space. I went from rockstar Piet Viljoen to rockstar Cy Jacobs. I've got rockstar Magnus Haystack in after our tea break. So thank you very much. I really appreciate it.